On the left. Shelley's good. It's February 12, 2015. This is the House Ag and Natural Resources Committee. We are convened. Welcome, everyone. The first bill up this morning is House Bill 2687 and provides the exception to the offense of carrying dogs on the external part of a vehicle. Mr. Gallagher, is there anything additional to add to that?
No, Mr. Chair. Members of the committee, I think that sums it up.
Very good. With that, do we have a witness sign up for this bill? Anybody signed up? I know that Representative Gomberg needs to be in other places here very shortly. Welcome to our committee, folks. Good morning.
Good morning, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Thank you so much for your courtesy and your accommodation in adjusting the schedule this morning. I am David Gomberg, State Representative from House District 10 on the Central Coast. And with me today...
I'm Marianne Nash. I'm the Public Policy Counsel for the Oregon Farm Bureau.
And I am Sharon Harmon with the Oregon Humane Society.
Good morning and welcome to each of you.
Thank you so much. And I will be brief, Mr. Chairman. This measure was requested by the Oregon Humane Society. Current law indicates that dogs cannot be traveling on the exterior of a vehicle except in a secured capacity. And this is a fairly simple and straightforward bill that would provide an exemption to that statute for farm vehicles. That being said, I'll turn it over to the other two witnesses.
Thank you very much, Representative. And if you have to leave now, fine. Whenever you have to run, just feel free.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman. I'm an elected official. I'll stay on camera as long as I can.
And an honest politician at that, sir.
Wow.
Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, I represent the Oregon Humane Society. We are a moderate animal welfare agency based in Portland, Oregon, but we have statewide membership across Oregon. We're here in support of this bill, but I have to say the bill didn't quite come out of legislative council as we had asked for it. We're looking to clarify that an external part of the vehicle clearly means the bed of a pickup truck. We're looking to eliminate some of the vagueness that animals have to be secured in when they're in the external part of a vehicle. I think we've all had the experience of driving behind someone with a dog who's bouncing back and forth, head hanging in the wind, ears flapping, and you all know how nervous that makes you. We've all had the experience of seeing those animals and wondering, is he going to fall? Do I have to swerve? Slowing down. For me personally, I've just gotten off the road and gotten so I didn't have to witness what was a tragedy. In my experience working in shelters, I've seen dogs come in with road rash from being bounced out of a truck. I've seen dogs that have been bounced out of a truck going over a cattle grate and having their legs broken. I think we can do better for pets. We have a long history of collaboration on legal matters, and we hope to work with the Oregon Farm Bureau to make sure that legitimate farming uses are exempted. That's how the exemption's in there. Unfortunately, the only thing that came out was the exemption out of legislative council. So I apologize for taking up your time, and we'll be back with an amendment that clarifies that.
So just to be clear, if it's an instance where we have a working dog engaged in actual farm work, you wouldn't have a problem with that then?
I think that's just the nature of making laws that meet the needs of the state.
Thank yes. You very, very much.
Chair, members of the committee, I'm Marianne Nash with the Oregon Farm Bureau. And we are here today just to say we do support the farm exemption. Right now it's currently only for vehicles that carry the farm plate. And as you know, sometimes trucks that are, you know, out when folks are working cattle won't necessarily carry the farm plate. So we're also committed to working with the Humane Society to see if we can reach an agreement on kind of an appropriate crafting of this legislation.
Okay, and just to make sure, the same question that I asked Ms. Harmon a moment ago, if it's outside of a working dog actually engaged in work performance, you wouldn't have a problem with her amendment?
Well, we just need to see how the amendment ends up coming out and what's covered. But, yeah, I think, you know, as it's currently written, the law applies to vehicles on highways. And so what the current law is, we understand that and we're working within that. So
thank you very much. Appreciate that. Committee members, questions or comments for this panel?
Thank you.
We've got to provide a little more camera time here, folks. Vice Chair McLean, please.
That last issue, I want to go back and read the, you know, what the law is right now. But you're just talking about highways, roads. You're not talking about on the farm or on the ranch. It's just on public
mm-hmm.
roads.
Okay. Mm-hmm. The bill currently covers highways, and you can't have farm vehicles on highways. So that's, I think, part of what the exemption's getting at.
Yeah.
Okay. Yes, Representative Barreto, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Actually, it's more of a question as to this process, since I'm new at it. You're going to go back and amend this bill, and then you're going to present it again? Is that how that works?
Yeah, basically.
Okay. Yes, and depending upon how complicated or not that amendment may be, it may be sufficient, Representative, for us to just have that discussion among ourselves when it comes forward. If it's rather extensive, I may just so that committee members are clear on what the amendment entails, we might just do a briefing on that amendment before we actually would take a vote to add it into the bill or not.
Okay.
Anything further?
Thank you all.
Thank you all very, very much. Appreciate it. And next, I'd like to call up, please, B.J. Anderson. We're getting a...
I did get that.
Okay. Thank you very much. Anyone else from the public who would like to testify this morning on House Bill 2687? I'm not seeing anyone. Folks, we can anticipate an amendment coming forward on that bill as well. And with that, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2687. Excuse me. Next up, folks, we have House Bill 2653. I'm opening a public hearing on that bill. Chuck, if you would, please.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, this measure requires State Department of Agriculture to establish standards for locating apiaries in residential zones in Oregon.
Thank you very much. And I'd like to call up, please, Fred Vanetta and Joe Marish, please. Gentlemen, welcome to our committee. And I understand we might have stirred up a bee's hive here.
Oh.
Oh.
Wow.
It's not even 8:15. Best I could do.
Piece of advice, Mr. Chair, keep your day job.
Nice. Gentlemen, welcome to our committee. Please decide among yourselves who goes first, and please proceed.
I am Fred Vanetta. I reside at 347 Ewald Avenue, Salem, Oregon, along with several thousand honeybees who have whose predecessors have been there for 40 some years. The president of the Oregon State Beekeepers Association asked me to come and testify on the bill before you today. I, by the way, have been a beekeeper in Oregon for 63 years. Only a portion of that spent in Salem. The Oregon State Beekeepers Association would prefer the legislation not be passed. The result, they fear that the result may be unfriendly to current beekeepers who have relationships in bees in cities. We also know that nothing government does is for free. I'm unable to find any evidence of a fiscal impact statement on this bill, but somebody's going to have to pay for it, and there's a concern among the beekeepers that they're going to wind up with some kind of a fee to pay for the preparation and administration of the regulations. So that quickly and briefly is our testimony from the state home builders, or from the state beekeepers association.
Thank you very much.
My name is Joe Marish, and I'm the president of the Portland Metro Beekeepers Association, and I live at 13601 South Union Hall Road, Canby, Oregon. And about we have a membership of about 75 paying participants, and our membership is scattered all over the Portland metro area, from Mount Hood, Washington County, Multnomah County, and we're not the only beekeeping group in the Portland area. There's the Portland Urban Beekeepers, but I've been keeping bees for 15 years. My brother, who lives in Portland, also keeps bees, and our concern is that some of our members would be regulated out of a place to keep bees, and that to us is not acceptable. Also, we're concerned, as Fred said, we're very concerned about, you know, regulations come down, then there's going to be fees, and we're concerned about that. We realize that, you know, we may not prevail, but we really do hope that if something happens and there is a bill, that we're consulted. We're really terrified of this. This is not beekeeping for most of us. Is at best, money. It's we don't make money off of it, and to have fees show up is very difficult. My brother, who lives in Portland, lives in North Portland. He doesn't have all of his bees in one spot. He's got two here, three there, one over there, and and he's not the only one. And to pay for apiary sites that would basically kind of put him out of business. Okay. And we really believe that if a local municipality or county wants to pass regulation, we're able to deal with that by going and talking to those local folks, those people that are making those decisions. And we're real good at that. We know who our, you know, county representative is, or maybe our city council people. We're real good at that. I know the city of Portland regulates bees. It's not a very good regulation. We're trying to change that. But the city of Milwaukee has different regulation, basically no regulation. What we're saying is that for the state Department of Agriculture to come out and make rules that affect all municipalities within the state would probably be a mistake. You know, Grants Pass is different than Portland, Oregon. in LeGrand, in Pendleton. So we would, that's where we're coming from. Okay? Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Appreciate your testimony and your comments, making sure that the legislation that we pass out of this building actually serves the needs of the folks that we regulate. So your comments are exceedingly helpful, and thank you for appearing. Committee members, any of you have questions or comments on this?
I guess I have one question.
Oh, okay. Representative McEwen first, then on deck is Representative Esquivel.
Gentlemen, I appreciate you taking your time out of your day to be here to help educate us. This is an area I do not have a lot of expertise in. And I guess it would be helpful to me if you could kind of characterize for me, if you took, you know, your 70 people who are in your organization, sir, or the folks that you know who enjoy this as a hobby or an avocation or a business, whatever it is. This is an industry I don't understand very well. I guess industry is too big a word. Is this a hobbyist practice? Is this a practice where it's done because we need pollinators and we all know that, and it's something that you enjoy providing in your neighborhoods? Is honey production a piece of this for your own home use, or are you producing honey at a rate that you can make a few dollars on it? Can you just help educate me about the folks that are involved in this that are more urban than rural, it sounds, for this particular bill?
Can you answer?
Yes.
I mean, I love my dogs. It may be that bees are just, you know, kind of a creature that is something that people enjoy being around.
Try to give you an overview here is that most of our members are what we would call hobbyists. And that means they have 1 to 5 colonies, hives, okay? And most of them, you know, will get a surplus of honey. But then there's the guys like probably there's a few more of us like myself where we run what you'd call maybe a sideliner, but it's really not a sideline. I do pollination services. I sell honey at a farm stand at my driveway. Most my brother, he sells honey at the Oregon at the excuse me. At the St. John's Farmers Market. Some of these folks do pollination services. He does. Mm-hmm. He also sells honey. But a lot of these people are backyard beekeepers that are doing this because they have fruit trees in their neighborhood, and they're doing it for their own consumption. Most people get a surplus of honey, so they're going to sell it. Okay, so there is some income. Usually the income does not make up for the cost of the bees and the equipment. I'm not sure if I'm answering what your
I think
question.
You are. What I'm hearing you say is there is a range.
There is
somebody
a range.
Who has a hive in their backyard for their apple trees. But then if the pollination services means you're moving hives around to provide a service for somebody who's commercially growing.
That's correct. I do that.
Bees.
I move bees to California. I move bees in Kaiser for cherries. I do some blueberry pollination out by Canby. I do pumpkins, apples. That's what I do. I also, like I say, I have more colonies, so that's why I'm up to about 20 to 40 colonies, depending upon the time of the year. Most urban beekeepers are smaller scale, but there are some that do have quite a few colonies, and they keep them usually in, a couple of guys that I know, they keep them around areas in the Port of Portland that the Port of Portland controls in, you know, in the city limits mm-hmm. of Portland, but they're not in somebody's backyard, okay?
Follow up, Mr. Chair.
Please.
So
I mean, this bill references any residential zone. So if you took your 70 members of your organization, how many of those would be practicing their beekeeping within a residential zone, or how many are outside a residential zone would be considered more rural?
At least half, if not more like 65 to 70%, but at least half of our members are living in what we would call a residential area. In other words, that's covered by the city limits of a municipality. Then there are the people that live, like, as you know, you may or may not know, like, in Clackamas County, there are parts of Clackamas County that are, which I would consider heavily residential, that are outside of the, you know, they're not incorporated, so to speak. So they're covered by the county.
Thank you. Mr. Chair, that...
Thank you. Yes.
That does beg a question. When it's talking about within any residential zone, are we referring to inside a city limit? How are we determining residential zone here?
Vice Chair Krieger just asked a very similar question, and I think it might be helpful if we had Mr. Gallagher run down to LC and see if they have a definition of what constitutes that residential zone. I think that may play somewhat significantly here. I'm not sure. So,
Bob, then thank you for helping educate me. That was very helpful. I appreciate you being here.
Thank you. I have next Representative Esquivel, then followed by McLean, followed by Frederick, followed by Whitsitt.
Everyone, in other words. thank you, Mr. Chair. On the residential zone part, I would assume that that could be construed as any zoning we have that would have a house on it, including EFU land that has a residential area up to SFR 10 or SFR 20 would be the thing. I think this thing needs some shortening, because you don't want to put anything in an SFR 20. Single-family residence, 20 per acre. I mean, that's apartment buildings, things like that. You want to be very careful there. But I would like to see some kind of an avenue or a vehicle in which people within a municipality can, in fact, have bees. My wife and I looked into it. We were going to put a beehive in our backyard. We have about a third of an acre in downtown Medford, but it's kind of like an island out there where there's no one around us. And come to find out, it's against the city ordinance. Mm-hmm. So we could not do that. That's too bad, because it would have been beneficial to everyone within the neighborhood itself. So anyway, that's my spin on it. I hope we can get something that we can, in fact, have bees in certain areas. But there's other areas we don't want them.
Thank you very much, Representative. And I would... if no one else asked the question, when it gets to be my turn, I'm going to ask if the state were to preempt, if this legislation were state legislation that were to preempt local regulation of bees, so that we had one regulation mechanism across the state, if that would in any way change your opinion of the bill. And I want to give you the time to think about that before we pose the question. Vice Chair McLean, please.
I was wondering if there were any organizations like the Oregon State Extension Office that have, you know, guidance for good beekeeping. I remember when my dad was raising bees that he went to the Extension Office and got a lot of information that really talked about how to keep bees and how to be a good neighbor and those types of things. So I was just wondering if you have a state organization or a national organization, or use the Extension Office to help with that.
Take that back and talk to our members.
Yes, I think so. Yeah.
I'm sorry. I'm hopefully temporarily hearing impaired, and so.
Okay.
What you're asking is that there is a state beekeepers association, and most of the clubs or groups like mine are affiliated with that organization. We do not, that I know of, have a handbook that we hand out to people saying this is, we tell people when you know, if you're going to keep bees in an urban area, mm-hmm. what you need to do. You need to provide water. You need to provide a way that, you know, we usually put a barrier up so that they don't go in the neighbor's backyard or in their swimming pool. It's real easy to control these things. And yes, you can have bees right next to a very large complex and not bother anybody. These things are not, you know, it depends, but we do not, I don't know of any basically booklet, or I think that's what you're asking.
Okay. Thank you.
Thank you very much. Is that...
That's fine.
Okay, very good. I'd like to call next on Representative Frederick, please.
Thank you, Chair Witt. We have, on my block, we used to have two sets of hives. We only have one now. It's one block over, actually, from me. And then there are other folks that I know that also have hives as well. And I think the city of Portland has its own set of regulations surrounding that, which basically requires that you notify folks within a certain area, a certain radius of the hives, about what's needed or that you have bees. This has been going on for some time. What is the... Do we have a sense of the regulations in other states? Is it a patchwork kind of thing across the state? How is it handled? Do you know?
It's a patchwork of things across the state. If a municipality regulates bees, there's no. It's all different. And like I said before, keep this in mind. Portland is different than Grants Pass. Mm-hmm. Gresham, give you an example. I'll take bees out to pollinate berries or apples in the Gresham area, and that very well may be in the city limits. I don't know, but but it's like Gresham's different than downtown Portland. And these bees are, somebody's paying to have these bees brought in to pollinate a crop, okay?
Out in Gresham.
Right. I'm not sure if I can totally answer your question, but that I know I have an idea of what the Portland regulations are. I think that they're grossly unfair because they... to beekeepers, but they're what they are, and people are keeping bees in the city of Portland.
Well, I know that they are because I get the honey from them, and also have I see the folks who are working on them mm-hmm. around my neighborhood. So, right. And I have a very concentrated neighborhood. So yeah. it's interesting to see that there's what the issue is. That's what I'm curious about right now. Thank you.
You know, for us, the issue is we need to have places to keep them. And there is, when it comes to bees, there's a lot of misinformation out there. People are terrified of them because they might get stung, right? And it's true, bees can sting you, but they're not out, they don't chase you down the street unless you did something crazy.
Thank you.
Thank you very much. Representative Whitsitt, please.
My question, thank you, Chair, is really, I was wondering what we're trying to address here, specifically the reason for it, which sort of follows up on Rep. Frederick's question. Are we worried about the bees colonizing in the wrong places, like going into somebody's attic or something like that? You know, I read about a house that... Yep. had a massive colony of bees in it, or people being stung, or hybridizing with like African bees and being out of the control. I mean, I'm just trying to understand.
Representative Witsit, what I'd like to do is if I could ask you to hold that question, and if there are no further pressing questions at this moment, I would like to ask Representative Gorsuch, please, to take the stand. And I probably should have asked him up first, and readily admit to probably having made a mistake here as the chair. I'd like him to introduce that bill. And Representative Gorsuch, I apologize, sir. The floor is yours.
Okay. Do you want me to go down here? Or
start? Your choice.
I'd rather go down there.
Please do.
Okay.
Thank you. Please join them. Please, it might be helpful if you'd like to sit there with a panel.
Well, actually, I have,
oh, you have some more.
I
okay.
Have some
All right.
So, yeah.
Thank you, gentlemen, very, very much. Appreciate your testimony, and we may call you back up here.
Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Gorsuch, again, my apologies and welcome. And I recognize that if I had called on you first, we might have been able to avoid a lot of the line of questioning here. And for that, I apologize.
No worries. For the record, I'm Chris Gorsuch, representative from District 49, East Multnomah County. Obviously, there's a lot of buzz about this particular bill. Thank you, Representative, for your support. So I just read a little thing, and then I'm going to turn it over to my witness here. Most of us are well aware, as we were seeing here earlier, of the profound concerns there are regarding the collapse of bee colonies. There's a lot of problems with that, and the health of apiary populations in general. One way that we can help with encouraging a robust and genetically diverse set of hives is to have a lot of different beekeepers around our region and state. And you saw a couple of those gentlemen just now. Joining us today to discuss the reasoning behind the bill is one of my residents. It's Rainey
Ritalto.
Okay. An accomplished residential beekeeper who was instrumental in the creation of Gresham's beekeeping statute. She rallied the support of 4,400 people to her petition, bringing that energy to bear so that she could see something done to provide certainty for those keeping hives and their neighbors that might be sensitive to bee stings. And so that's obviously a concern, as was already brought up. Having a standard that municipalities can turn to, I feel, would make the process more streamlined than the years it took to develop in places like the city of Portland, the city of Gresham. And so we need to make sure that people making the investments in beekeeping can all gain from checking in with neighbors and are able to meet basic expectations for safety, as well as providing the beekeepers themselves with certainty after they've made these efforts and initiated an endeavor that requires both a great deal of time and money. So what this bill does, we're talking here now about 2653, is that it would have the State Department of Agriculture establish a basic set of standards that then municipalities could turn to in creating their own statutes. There are no fees involved. There are no requirements. There are no penalties in this bill. But it is designed to get a set of standards that are uniform across the state. Because as you saw in testimony before, some places have them, some places don't. Some are more stringent, some are less stringent. And so what we're trying to do is create something that will support a really important activity. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. Good morning and welcome to our committee.
Good morning. Thank you. I wanted to thank Representative Gorsuch for taking my petition and turning it into a bill proposal. Just really appreciate that.
And before you start your testimony, would you please introduce yourself?
Oh, I'm sorry. I'm Rain Ritalto.
Thank
I'm a
you.
Beekeeper
thank you very
in
much.
Portland.
Good morning.
Good morning. How this started for me is I lived in Portland, and I moved from Portland to Portland, I thought, because I had a Portland address. I found out that I actually moved to Gresham. And in moving to Gresham,
I was a beekeeper in Portland. Now, all of a sudden, in Gresham, urban beekeeping is not allowed. It's not been allowed since 2011. I've been lobbying them since then. We finally, I hope, cross my fingers, next month there's a proposal finally to put code in to beekeep. So this is a lot of what this bill is about, is basically trying to get the doors opened across the states for beekeeping, because they're not. And this is not just an Oregon issue, it's a national issue. There are other people out with petitions to their cities trying to get them to open the doors for cities that will not open the doors for beekeeping. So that was the whole reason for the petition that's become this bill proposal. So today, city rules around residential beekeeping aren't uniform. That's onerous and discriminatory to beekeepers. Some things I want you to think about as I'm sort of talking and you're considering this bill is that beekeeping is one of the oldest professions. So it's not something new that we just invented that we have no idea about. the actual statistic fact is that less than 1% of the population is bee allergic. So all of these cities that are closing their doors in fear or whatever is ridiculous around a 1% statistic. You know, I was a project manager at U.S. Bank for 23 years. I've done a lot of risk ratio analysis stuff. I've never in my life encountered a risk ratio so low as 1%. So to prohibit on a 1% doesn't make sense. Regardless of the city that we're talking about, beekeeping risk is the same. It's the same process. We keep bees the same way. You know, there may be differences in the city, you know, to accommodate, and that's fine. So prohibiting residential beekeeping also prohibits related micro and small business opportunities. So you're losing business in your cities. You're reducing your self-sufficiency opportunities because your backyard gardens aren't going to get the pollination volume that they need to really be productive. And then the hive products that you could be having are both useful to your health and your family household for making products. So you're blocking that too. So some of the differences in the cities, Portland allows up to 15 beehives per residential city lot, 15. Gresham doesn't allow any. Out in Washington County, there are no rules whatsoever about beekeeping. So this is some of the thing. Some of the cities require neighbor notifications and or sign-offs, and some cities don't. Sometimes you need a beekeeping permit and there's fees, sometimes you don't. You know, there's no standard number of beehives per residence across cities that allow the residential beekeeping. And generally speaking, when you exceed 4 beehives, it's thought to be a separation point between a hobbyist and a commercial beekeeper, because the Oregon state requires that you register more than 4 hives. And when you talk to them about that logic, that's what they're saying, is if you're up above 4, then we think you're a commercial beekeeper. So Portland's allowance of 15 beehives per residence, to me, is really surprising. 4 years ago, they only allowed 4, and now we're up to 15. And just to sort of give you some ideas, a low winter population of bees in a hive is about 3,000 to 5,000 bees. So in peak summer production, we're talking 60,000 to 80,000. Now times that by 15 in every backyard. I mean, if every person in Portland, I'm just saying that's a lot of bee volume. And I personally question whether there is enough foraging plants just year round to support that kind of bee volume. I don't know how that got to 15. That's something I recently found out about. It really surprised me.
Ms. Ritalto, I think there are a couple of committee members here that have some questions.
Okay.
Would you mind if we moved into questions at this point? Vice Chair Krieger.
I think she kind of hit on it, but what motivated the cities to prohibit beekeeping? Was it the fact that somebody was getting stung, or there were people that were allergic? What was it?
Well, see, when I asked that to Gresham, they don't know. It's just been that way for, you know, forever. It's And they really could never answer me. I probed and probed for that.
Representative Esquivel. I'm sorry.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Maybe to respond to Representative Krieger's question, I believe that we did, in the city of Medford, did an ordinance for blanket for cattle, horses, so on and so forth. Now, they've made an exception here lately for chickens only, and I think it's as long as you don't have a rooster, you're okay, because they don't like that disturbing the peace. But and bees were included in that, I believe. So I think it progressed in my community.
Have free-range chickens, Representative Esquivel?
No, actually, you have to contain those little buggers. Flip their wings, make sure they can't get to the neighbor.
Representative Barreto, please.
You know, the way this is played out, and I'm not so sure, you know, I appreciate Representative Gorsuch kind of bringing clarity to the issue.
Yes.
But, you know, when we make or write up a legislative draft, it has what's the problem, what's the solution, and it would be very nice, I think, before we have these hearings, if we had that what is the problem part in the legislative draft so that we can view this, you know, as we prepare for it, we can view it from a right perspective.
But that may be a very good suggestion, Representative.
And if I may, Mr.
Please.
Chair. To that end as well, if we were to move this legislation, I think it would be really important for the bill to have a piece that says that we want the Department of Agriculture to work with beekeepers in creating these rules, not simply impose them from above. Mm-hmm. So I think that would be help with the solution.
Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Further questions or comments? So we've heard the testimony here this morning, both your own panel as well as the preceding one, that we do have a mishmash of regulations.
Right.
Some outright banning, others different than the neighboring community. And I think, Representative, I just heard you say that you may prefer not to preempt local regulation by the state.
Well, yeah, I don't see this bill as something that would say, okay, everybody has to have bees, and that everybody has to do it our way. I think what we're looking for is a minimum set of standards. If cities wanted to do things above and beyond that, I think it would be just fine. But the idea is to get at least a consistent base across the state in terms of what are, and that would be based on best practices in discussing with beekeepers and others.
Is there any interest in granting permissions statewide for people to keep bees if they meet certain best practices and criteria? Or do we want to continue to allow municipalities to ban, just a blanket ban without any consideration or other concerns?
Well, you know, go ahead.
Actually, Mr. Chair, I'd like to see something that we could put out to the Department of Ag and allow municipalities to reevaluate what they've done when it comes to regulations and ordinances on bees, because I really think that the only reason that ours was because it was a wide sweeping ordinance. But I think if people could reevaluate at least that one segment of that ordinance, I think they'd probably have a different outcome.
Okay. And Mr. Chair, I think
just like chickens,
because chickens and bees can be free range. But I think, too, in light of Representative Reardon and some of his work in terms of colony collapse and things like that, this is a really important issue. And so if we can find a way to not, you know, get people stung, but to get more bees out there. When I first met my constituent here, we were in a park over in Gresham. Now, you would think a park, you know, there'd be bees. There wasn't any bees around. You know, when I was a kid going to a park, you know, there were always bees around. So we've created these kind of sterile, almost deserts in many of our cities. And so to help with things like colony collapse, I would say that, you know, working to help create more beekeepers would be better. And that's probably going to help if we have a kind of a common footprint to work from.
Thank you very much. Any additional questions or comments from the committee? I want to thank you both very, very much. And again, Representative Gorsuch, my apologies, sir.
No worries, sir.
All right.
Thank you.
I would like next to please call up Harrison Conley so he can explain to us just what the definition of a residential zone is that we're considering in this bill. Welcome, sir, and thank you for making yourself available literally on a moment's notice.
Thank you, Harrison Conley, Senior Deputy Legislative Counsel. Thank you, Chair Witt, members. And that's a good question. What is a residential zone? You guys have not asked me to define that in the past, so I don't know.
We're in trouble.
Definitely not good.
Well, let me start with a disclaimer, something that it is not. In the state statutes, we do talk about exclusive farm use zones, mixed farm and forest zones, and forest zones. And those are not, in fact, zones as we probably intend in this bill. The zones are really usually city or county land use designations under the statewide comprehensive planning process. So we require cities and counties to do comprehensive planning. Within the context of comprehensive plan, they make comprehensive plans, they make designations primarily for resource uses or urbanized uses. And then within that context of comprehensive plan designations, cities and counties designate areas or zone areas primarily for industrial use, primarily for commercial use, primarily for residential use. I couldn't begin to keep up with all of the local zones. Within residential zoning, there may be 5 to 15 zones locally. But what we're talking about with a zone is the predominant use is residential, and other uses that are allowed within the area should be compatible with residential use, or if, in fact, they were in the area when the zone was designated, they're usually grandfathered in as a non-conforming use. We could certainly do something to try to craft a definition of residential zone, but I'm not aware that we've really ever tried to do anything like that in statute because it is primarily a local designation.
Thank you very much. Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you. Hi, Harrison. How are you doing?
Good. Good, sir.
I think that Representative Gorsuch, I think I would try to look into something that we could craft that wouldn't have an exceed a certain number of units per acre.
Sure.
SFR4 would be single family residence 4 per acre. SFR6 I think would be the maximum, because if you start, I mean, I can just see having a apartment complex and some guy with a bee hive in his front
on one porch right next door to somebody else
to get to your own apartment.
Yeah.
You know, you have to plan for the bad there.
So do you think that would, Mr. Chair?
Yes.
Do you think that would be possible to craft something as Representative Esquivel has suggested?
I'm sorry, I sort of missed that last piece, but is this your suggestion that we encourage local governments to review broad bands of agricultural animals, of chattels?
Correct, but what I'm saying is we should try to give a guideline of some kind of a limitation on the single family residence per acre. Example, we don't want I don't think the municipalities would like to have in an SFR 20, say 20 units per acre, which would be an apartment complex. They would like to have people keeping bees in those.
Yeah.
Because, you know, some guy's going to put something on their front porch you have to walk past. You know, you've seen them like a, mm-hmm. you know, where you have to walk past it. But on the other hand, I'd like to see something maybe crafted just for a suggestion for them as a guideline, maybe. And Department of Ag should have some kind of an input on that as well as the beekeepers.
We can, yes.
Okay, well, yes, Representative Witt, Representative Esquivel. That sort of goes to what we were describing there with residential zones being maybe 1 to 15 with various focuses in any particular type of residential zone. So I can certainly see where beekeeping might work best where there are yards.
Right. That's what I'm getting at.
And this, as drafted now, this is certainly open to the, exactly that kind of differentiation by the Department of Agriculture. We could be more explicit that that is our intention.
Thank you very much for that suggestion, and may have a couple of you get together and work on something. And I know, Rep. Esquivel, you probably are as familiar with this zoning as anyone on our committee, so maybe
you
would be able to
bees.
Work with Representative Gorsuch on that. Representative Frederick, please.
Yes, thank you, Chairwick. I want you to recognize as well that there are beekeepers that in fact set up their hives on the roofs of apartment complex.
Mm-hmm. Oh, I didn't know that.
Yeah. So around the country, around the world. So this is not just a backyard situation. You have folks who are setting up a number of hives on the roofs of apartment complexes around the world. So keep that in mind. It's okay. It's just not setting things up.
Good thought. Very
important point there. Thank you. Any additional questions for Mr. Conley before we let him get back to his very busy work schedule here? Mr. Conley, thank you so much.
Thank you.
Truly appreciated. I would just like to call back again, please, our first panel, and see if they have any responses to some of the discussion that we've had here since you were first up.
Let me introduce myself. I'm Ralph Rodia. I reside at 4194 12th Street Southeast in Salem, Oregon. I'm a past officer of the Salem Willamette Valley Bee Association, a member of the local Willamette Valley Bee Association, and the State Association. I've been involved with a number of cases, calling cases or challenges to cities who have restricted beekeeping for one reason or another. And in most cases, the cities have backed off of very onerous rules, which do no favor for beekeepers or really the city themselves. In answers to a couple of questions you've posed to other members, is cities back in the early 70s, roughly, throughout the country, were establishing regulations relating to farm animals, particularly, as Representative Esquil have said. And they have in their statutes in many cities limits on bees. Most of these statutes are ignored for the most part until somebody raises the issue, for instance, asks the question, can we keep bees? And then somebody looks at the statute and says, no, you can't. Well, they never did anything about it before somebody asked the question. Or a neighbor has complained about bees for one reason or another, and somebody digs out the statute and says, no, you can't have bees. It's a problem throughout the state, okay? Not just in the city areas. It's throughout. Now, answer a couple of other questions. There are guidelines. The state of Oregon does not have guidelines per se with respect to either the local or the state associations that are passed out. However, this issue is not a new issue throughout the country. This has been coming up again and again. And so other states have actually adopted, or their bee organizations have adopted, best management practices for beekeepers in populated areas, or best management practices for maintaining honeybee colonies in Ohio, or best practices for urban beekeepers in North Carolina, or Vermont best management practices, or beekeeping practices in Virginia, for instance. And these are just a few of them. I haven't got 15 copies. I didn't bring those with me. So there are around. I will tell you, however, though, the official position of the state association and the local association is we really don't want rules. And the reason is if you have rules, then they're enforceable. And just speaking from former state employee of an enforcement agency, if you're going to have rules, then you're going to have people to enforce them. If you're going to have people to enforce them, then you're going to have money to pay for people to enforce them. And so what often happens, as Department of Ag has right now, has rules already for some aspects of beekeeping, not this aspects. They have no funding for inspectors to go out and enforce those rules. And so if you're going to propose adopting some kind of rules, are you going to have an enforcement aspect of those rules? Or are they simply voluntary? Or are you going to adopt guidelines? And are you going to override the cities in the process? And to what extent? Now, there is one state, by the way, Georgia, who has actually adopted, and it's in, I forgot to bring it with me, but it's in 2-4.1.1, that actually prohibits the local, any local municipality adopting any rules, regulations, statutes, restrictions on beekeeping, other than what the state has actually set forth. So now I'm going to speak a little bit out of turn here in a sense, that the next thing I say is not the official position of either the state association or the local.
Sir, before you proceed.
Yes.
I would like to give Representative Gorsuch, I think, an opportunity here to either question or make
yes.
a statement.
Yeah. So it's an interesting thing to say, well, I don't think we can enforce it, so we shouldn't make it illegal. Because, I mean, we could make that argument right now about underfunding of the state police and then say, why do we have crimes anywhere? So, but are you saying that your organization wouldn't be interested in working to create a workable system across the state?
Okay, let me get back to my personal position,
okay.
having been a state official for quite a long time. In any case, the bee associations would be willing to work with you and would be glad to work with you if you're going to adopt any rules. They'd prefer not to,
mm-hmm.
okay? But as having been a state official, involved with a patchwork of rules, and then as a state official coming out with an oversight, I think there's an advantage to having at least a very, very minimal oversight.
Right.
Okay.
So if I may follow up. And here's the one thing, though, that is helped by this situation. If we had state standards, and then we could go to the cities and they would say, oh, okay, well, we've crafted this based on the state standard. I mean, they would still be able to say no. But then it wouldn't be this thing of, yeah, well, it's in statute from the 70s, so we don't allow for that. I mean, it would at least clean that piece up, don't you think?
Personally, I agree with you.
Okay. So, thank you, Mr. Chair.
Thank you. Representative McEwen, before we resume testimony.
Chair Whit, thank you. I'm not sure this is germane to this conversation or not, but I'm looking in the Oregon Department of Ag website, and right now, updated September 3rd of 2014, any person who owns 5 or more colonies of bees located in Oregon, and it doesn't designate where, is required to register with the Oregon Department of Agriculture. Mm-hmm. So that's already on the books. And I was also looking at the Oregon State University Extension website, and they have a number of programs for different certifications for different levels of expertise in this avocation. So there are a number of things already in place. I'm just kind of curious as to, as people who are experienced in this, we already have the Department of Ag having a modicum of oversight in that registration is required. If you have more than 5, if you have 5 or less, you don't have to register. How is this working for you now?
I'll speak to that. It's really not working, and I'll tell you what. I registered. Okay, I paid my $10, and I said, but nothing happens. And there are many beekeepers that don't register. Basically, years ago, there used to be, the state had an apiary, set of apiary inspectors, and they'd come around. If you were registered with the state, they'd come around and look at your beehives. Mm. That's not happening now, and it hasn't happened for a long time. Probably funding, okay? That's it's, you know, you're asking how this is working. I'm part of the state's master beekeeper program. Mm-hmm. I'm a mentor. I mentor people that are part of that program, and that works well, but not everybody's
follow-up
goes through that.
So in essence, the $10 fee, I know there's not a direct correlation, but the Department of Ag is producing ongoing training, and the Extension Service is providing opportunities for people who want to learn how to be effective beekeepers, how to use best practices. So that is out there, and that is covered by the Department of Ag as an expense.
Well, excuse me. I'll make a quick correction here. The Oregon State Beekeepers and Oregon State University.
The Extension Service.
No, not well. Yes, through the Extension Service,
right.
But it's basically, it's not really the Extension Service. It is Oregon State University, okay? It's not, the Oregon Department of Agriculture doesn't really do anything. The only thing that I know, they've investigated bee die-offs a couple of times, mm-hmm. Okay?
Okay.
That's the only thing that I personally know of.
Okay, thank you.
And for the record, that last line of questioning engaged with Representative McEwen was between herself and Mr. Marish.
That's correct.
I am going to have a response here from Representative Gorsuch, and then I'm going to allow our witnesses to complete their testimony before we proceed with a full line of questioning here. Representative Gorsuch.
As I'm sitting here and thinking about the testimony, it seems to me that perhaps the better way to approach this bill is to instruct Department of Agriculture to work with the state beekeepers to craft some sort of statewide base level way of handling bees across the state, and then bring that back to the legislature for review and voting on best practices.
Representative Gorsuch, I suspect before we leave here today, you're going to be heading up a work group.
Okay, all right, very good.
Gentlemen, please proceed.
One last thing.
And if you'd reintroduce yourself, because
okay.
We've had a number of people, just your name for the record.
Ralph Rodia. Live in Salem, Oregon.
That's adequate, sir. Thank you.
I did find the statute from Georgia. Let me read it to you because it's very short, okay? Prohibition against restriction of honeybee production or maintenance. And this is Georgia Statute 2-14-41.1. No county, municipal corporation, consolidated government, or other political subdivision of this state shall adopt or continue in effect any ordinance, rule, regulation, or resolution prohibiting, impeding, or restricting the establishment or maintenance of beehives, honeybees, and hives.
And that's citation again, sir?
That is Georgia Statute 2-14-41.1.
Okay. Very good. Representative Frederick.
I'm looking at the same regulation from Georgia, having lived there for a while, and I remember really well that some of those things. There's a whole section dealing with bees and bee maintenance, and I would encourage you to look at the whole section, not just that particular section of it. It includes a significant effort by way of the state of Georgia to monitor, to determine. To have inspections of one form or another, and there, there's a context to it that I think is important.
Thank you very much, Representative Frederick, and gentlemen, I'm not trying to unfairly pin anyone down. But as the chair of this committee, trying to get a sense of where the single major group interested in representing beekeepers in this state would prefer us to head, which direction, sir? The Georgia statute that you just read to us, or that portion of it, I could interpret as promoting state preemption. And I think earlier the testimony that we had suggested that you didn't want to go in that direction. I'm confused, and I want to know, to the best of your ability, which direction do you want us to go in?
The preference is no rules at all, and leave it up to the local districts, local cities to do it. But if there has to be rules, let them be minimal and don't let local cities enact additional rules or restrictions on top of all of the other, of whatever the state minimum might be.
Okay. And thank you. The chair still remains confused. Mm-hmm. Because as representatives of beekeepers, we have had testimony that the city of Gresham does not allow hives to be kept within city limits. And so is that's okay, too?
Let's put it this way. It's easier for beekeepers to address these issues with their local municipality. Okay, now the city of Gresham, which I did not know, has a ban on bees, what I've just learned here. I believe that my group and other beekeepers and the state association are willing to work with them to address those issues. Okay,
right.
Our preference, I'll state it real clear, is that there be no regulation. But if there is going to be regulation, the Oregon State Beekeepers Association, which I am, besides being the president of the Portland Metro Group, would be part of that rulemaking, that conversation. We need that.
All right.
Okay, and also, just this is kind of a little bit off your question here, but I'm going to throw it out there. Our group has a field day every year, and to help you out, I would like to invite all of you to our field day. It is on April 25th, and it is in Colton, Oregon, at Foothills Honey Farm, and the directions and all that can be gotten off of the Oregon State Beekeepers Association website. But I will, Representative Witt, make sure that I'll send you an invitation and for the committee.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that very much. Committee members, I'm going to have to move on to our final piece of or our final bill today. Does anyone have any further questions or comments? Committee members, I think I'm going to ask Representative Gorsuch to head up a work group to iron this out. Representative Esquivel, if you'd lend your expertise, and anyone else who's interested, as long as we don't have a quorum, I'd appreciate that very much. And you'll have a list of the witnesses as well to know who to work with. Is there anyone? Gentlemen, thank you very much. Appreciate your right before I close.
I'm sorry, Representative Witt, I did not hear the question.
It wasn't a question. I thought I had a signal from your panel member that you had a statement you wanted to make.
No, I think we can work out a problem. Work out the problem and take care of the Gresham issue.
Thank you. Thank you. If anybody can work out a problem, Fred Vanetta can work out a problem. And, sir, you're a beekeeper for how many decades?
63.
Amazing.
63 years?
Decades.
Absolutely incredible.
Wow.
Gentlemen, we certainly appreciate your presence here today and your testimony. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on House Bill 2653 today? Seeing none, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2653.
Thank you.
Mr. Gallagher, we have up next House Bill I'm going to open a public hearing on House Bill 2501. Mr. Gallagher, could you tell us a little bit about that bill?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, the measure requires that the annual report by the state forester to the emergency board include private property loss information for fires of 1,000 acres or more.
And do we have a witness sheet on this bill?
We do.
Okay. Very good. Thank you. Welcome to both of you. You're frequent flyers before our committee.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Witt, Vice Chair Krieger, Vice Chair McLean. I'm Representative Gail Whitsitt. I represent House District 56, which is the southern half of Lake and Klamath counties to the California border, the other end of the state, if you will. Senator Whitsitt and I are here to present House Bill 2501, which would include private property loss information on Oregon wildland fires of greater than 1,000 acres. When wildland fires are presented to the media, they are usually portrayed in size of acres, cost to fight the fire, life lost, and buildings lost. Nowhere do we ever hear about the incredible loss of private property and resources and their costs. These often include standing timber or log banks, livestock lost, barns, corrals, fences, and grazing resources, all of which can add up into the millions of dollars. These items are usually not covered by insurance, so the families and corporations often suffer total and complete loss. The genesis of the bill was the Berry Point Fire in Lake County, which occurred in the summer of 2013. It encompassed a total of 92,977 acres of forest and ranch land. Of that, the private company Collins Pond lost over 20,000 acres of their prime plantation forest, and several ranches suffered devastating losses of their livestock, 2 years of grazing land, buildings, and their entire incomes and livelihoods for several years as a consequence. Further fires in Klamath and Jackson counties in 2014 brought home the impact of these losses when several fires swept through the region, destroying mature plantations of pine on former JWTR, which is Jeldwin Associated Lands, which included already logged and stored log banks of timber which were waiting for transport to be processed. The personal losses, the loss to the county and state revenues, and the devastation of families and corporations cannot be underestimated. We would like the Department of Forestry to include these monetary estimates of property and grazing and livestock devastation to the emergency board when they make their annual report on wildfires. This would occur when the fire is over 1,000 acres or greater in totality. The estimation loss shall be submitted to the ODF with accompanying supportive information. And I've included for you to go through a flyer from one of the ranches that lost nearly everything in the Berry Point Fire. It's called the Highland Valley Ranch, and they had a great conservation program going on their ranch, and the pictures show before and after, so it gives people an idea of the devastation. And I'll turn it over to Senator Whitsitt now, who's a co-sponsor.
Thank you, Chair Witt, committee members. For the record, I'm Doug Whitsitt. I represent Senate District 28, which is Klamath, Crook, and most of the landmass of Lake, Deschutes, and Jackson counties. Fire reports may actually convince stakeholders that the damages caused by wildfires are much less than what actually occurs, that it's even minimal. In fact, Oregonians are often told that wildfires can have benefits that weighed as a whole may actually be beneficial to the forest and rangeland environment. I worked my way through college and professional school a lot of years ago fighting fire for the United States Forest Service. During that time, our hotshot crew helped to suppress more than 50 major wildfires in 9 western states. I have yet to see an out-of-control fire that is beneficial to any environment. Wildfires have many significant costs that are not currently being reported, including the loss of the timber value, loss of forage incinerated, and also many times it takes a year or two for that landscape to regenerate. So it's not just 1 year of forage lost; it's often 2 to 3, and particularly when it involves federal land, it's almost always 3 years. The value of real estate. I think the picture that you looked at there is serves its own description. What is once a pristine, beautiful place that anybody would like to live is the aftermath of a Holocaust. The value of lost and damaged livestock, certainly it's pretty easy to quantify how many cows died and were burned, you know, were burned up and what their value was. But there are a lot of livestock that are damaged, that live, but their productivity is greatly reduced, perhaps for a lifetime. The death loss among wildlife, birds, whatever, is immense during a fire and after a fire, the loss to the watersheds, and it goes on. And finally, the agencies don't even attempt to estimate the incredible amount of greenhouse gases emitted by wildfires. The massive emissions from wildfires are actually second only to volcanoes as a global source of greenhouse gases. The single greatest hazard for the Oregon Department of Forestry's wildfire protection is the nearly 25,000 miles of contiguous border that it shares with lands managed by the federal government. Out-of-control fires on federal land often cross those boundaries, resulting in massive damage to ODF-protected lands. We believe that the failed federal management of public resources will never be corrected until the people truly understand the magnitude of the cost and the mismanagement that is the direct cause of huge losses to private resources. House Bill 2501 represents a start toward providing the public with the information they need to understand the magnitude of those losses. The bill is not written to require, nor is it intended to require, a detailed catalog of all of the damages caused by wildfires. It is meant to ask the Department of Forestry to provide rough estimates of objectively measurable losses caused by wildfires on ODF-protected land. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much, Senator. That was a very comprehensive statement, and I was wondering if you might be able to make that statement available to our committee.
Absolutely.
Thank you, in written form. Thank you very much. Committee members, questions or comments? Vice Chair Krieger, please.
Senator and Representative, what's it? You've got it down as 1,000 acres. And that might be appropriate, but if you take 1,000 acres on the west side, 25,000 board feet per acre,
you're talking a bunch.
And put that out there, you know, 25 million board feet, we need to take that number way, way down. Because 100% of something on a 300 or 400 acre tree farm like mine, where I took $269,000 of revenue off of 10 acres, that would be a devastating loss to our family had that all burned. So I think we need to get a full picture, and I agree with you, a full picture of it. And so I think that number needs to be greatly reduced. And maybe you want to make a difference between east side, west side because of the volumes per acre. But at the same time, I think another thing is that if you had started the fire as a private owner, landowner, and it burned onto the federal land, you would be liable. And they would come after you like they did with a Pacific Lumber for $27 million, and they tried to steal, the federal government stole another 20,000 acres or something from the Pacific Lumber. But if it comes off the federal land on you, you have no recourse, and they're the ones that are doing the mismanagement that's causing a lot of these fires.
Representative Krieger, Chair Witt, Representative Krieger, I absolutely agree with you. We intended this bill to be a starting point. Candidly, we are trying to craft a bill that doesn't have a massive fiscal. So as a starting point, I think No, I mean, I certainly don't, and I won't speak for Representative Whitson, but I wouldn't have any concern about amending the bill to make it to more comprehensive. But I would be concerned that the, and rightfully, the Department of Forestry would have a more significant fiscal, the more comprehensive you make it.
Mr. Chair, sometimes
Please.
There's a cost to knowing the truth. And if you know the truth, maybe your policies will be different.
I agree.
Senator, you in your statement, you referenced the death and destruction that wildfire causes to wildlife. Mm-hmm. And assuming that threatened and endangered species are not immune to that death and destruction, we're faced, as you know is better than I in this state, with a potential shutdown of vast reaches of our state because of threatened and endangered species. This could potentially, the sage grouse alone could potentially shut down the whole east side of our state economically. If you add to that a number of other species, Representative Esquivel, I hate to say it, but we're playing with fire here. So, and not to make light of
word.
Not to make light of a very serious situation here. I think that what you are asking for here, both of you, is absolutely critical. Is a basis for us to begin the kind of landscape management that's going to be necessary for us to avoid the potential listing of species that's going to wreak havoc in this state. Now, if for whatever reason we don't have the willpower or the money or whatever, to be able to manage particularly our forests, but we've got problems with sagebrush growing in places that it shouldn't, juniper where it shouldn't. My son and I were antelope hunting here a few years ago. You see Mr. Welch in the back room nodding his head because he knew where I was. We were camped in a very extremely remote dry camp area where there was a lightning strike one evening, and we didn't have a way to get out. And I will tell you that you probably don't look at fire threats the same way ever again. We need to do something in this state in terms of being able to manage across our landscape so that we are not the tinderbox that in many places we are. Can you comment on the importance, please, of this kind of report as a means to start focusing some of our thought processes on landscape management in this state?
Yeah, absolutely. Thank you for the question. I think that we have a disconnect with a lot of people in urban areas that really have no, they have no comprehension of what a wildfire really is, and they often never see the aftermath of a wildfire, at least not up close and personal. And so, in order to drive policy, I mean, politics is a numbers game, whether we like it or not, that's what it is. And so I think it's incredibly important to actually give people, as Representative Krieger said, the truth. I mean, let's tell them like it is. It's not a good thing to burn up whole landscapes. It's not a good thing to burn up watersheds. We talk about managing logging roads to minimize the amount of silt that goes into a stream. Then we burn up an entire watershed where the silt fills the stream with ash and sediment destroys habitat for months, years. And this is a good thing. I mean, I think the people must be told what the problem is before we can begin to address the problem.
Thank you very much. And I would be hopeful too that this kind of study would be a basis upon which we could compare the costs of going out and thinning those forests and getting rid of some of that juniper and obtaining commercial commodity value for some of that juniper rather than burning the hillsides up. We could compare the costs of going and doing that kind of landscape management as opposed to the horrendous firefighting costs that we face in this state. And it's not to suggest that we end fire altogether, but at least hopefully we can begin to start getting a handle on out-of-control wildfire. And the public's assets are being burnt up, and that is very costly. And I, for one, don't think that there's necessarily an appreciation, because I don't think the information is out there for the public to begin to analyze that and say, you know what, this is costing us a heck of a lot of money not doing anything. Mm-hmm. So, Representative Gorsuch.
This whole problem, I think, underscores that difficult issue that we face between federal lands and state control. And, you know, I don't know if anyone realizes this, and I was out flying around with my bee things there, but I don't know if this came up in testimony, but something like half of the state of Oregon is not controlled by the state of Oregon. It's controlled by the federal government.
Yes.
And so the big problem there is how you get the federal government to move off the mark and help us with some of these things. I mean, I think that's one problem. And I think number two, you're absolutely right. There's too much of a disconnect in the state of Oregon between urban areas and rural areas. And people don't realize what national forests, frequently they don't, in my opinion, that they don't realize that national forests were set up not as preservation areas, but as conservation areas. Conservation means wise use. It doesn't mean closing them off. It means wise use. And so I completely support this approach, and I think Representative Krieger's right. The more data you can get, the better it is. So I applaud your efforts in this area.
Thank you. And to respond to that, I think it would be wonderful if we could direct the Forest Service to do this. We've had Representative Whitson and I and others have had prolonged conversations with foresters, federal foresters, to encourage them. We don't have the authority to force them to do it. And I want to be really clear that the Department of Forestry is not responsible, Oregon Department of Forestry is not responsible for this gross mismanagement. They're the recipient of it.
Right.
And I think they do a great job. But I think that, again, it's a matter of information.
I would just like to say, with regard to what we're talking about, making people aware, we took testimony on the Berry Point fire from children who went out with their fathers to find what was left of the ranches and found the carcasses of small and large animals, burned, incinerated, you know, and later livestock. And ungulates walked across the area while it was still too hot, and they burned their feet off. Their hooves fell off, and they had to go kill them. And I don't think the public really understands that it isn't just a loss at that moment or the extent of it. It affects all of the animals, the wild and domestic, and it was just horrifying to hear the poor little kids talk about going out and finding the animals who had stepped out of their hooves and the owners having to kill them. And I just don't think the public is aware of the incredible devastation mm-hmm. that this wreaks on animals, mammals in particular. So,
And I want to thank you. Thank you both. I want to correct my earlier statement, too. I got carried away a little bit. It's not. I didn't mean to suggest that our State Department of Forestry wasn't doing anything. And I think if we provide the public policy guidelines and the money, they are only too willing to continue the very excellent job that they're attempting to do with the exceedingly limited resources. So, with that, I have next Vice Chair McLean and then Vice Chair Krieger.
Well, I really appreciate the work on this, and I think it's a really good start to, as you indicated, providing more data and more information to all people and to the governments that are involved in this situation. A couple of times, though, you've mentioned the difference between urban and rural understanding, and I hope to be sort of the glue or maybe the in between. I've lived in small communities. I've lived in what I considered to be urban and rural areas in the sense that I was raised on farms and Marion and Clackamas County and have done a lot of outdoor kinds of camping and activities throughout the state. But I think people do understand health issues. And so I think that when we talk to each other in both urban and rural settings, when we talk about not just the loss of property and the loss of animals, because that's very important, but also about how it's affecting the overall environment, as you pointed out, on habitats and also on personal health. And I think in Southern Oregon, at least when I was down there during the last couple of summers and the kinds of fires that were there, there were a lot of people that really did understand that it may be way out there or way over there, but even in Talent or Ashland, there are people who are suffering because of the smoke and the damage coming from these horrendous fires.
Absolutely.
So I just think it's an opportunity for us to try and sell it to everybody, the whole group of folks we want to have some consideration on this, that it really is something that affects all of us, no matter where you live, no matter what kind of background or understanding you have.
It is, thank you. It is a, Chair Witt, Vice Chair McLean, it is a something of a poignant dichotomy that Klamath Falls is quite heavily regulated for wood smoke from stoves. Yet wildfires choke us to death in the summertime.
They do.
That's right.
That's a good point.
Point well made, Senator. Vice Chair Krieger.
I think we need to go back and talk about the value of the land, which is for many years destroyed. And I want to go back to the little thing that I did on my place, because it was around $35,000 in capital gains. I think around $3,700 in severance tax and a forest tax that was lost, that would have been lost to the state. And when you burn that land like that, it doesn't come back right away. It takes another 50 years on our side to develop a decent looking tree. And then the families that own that land don't have any income to maintain even paying the property taxes and the insurance. What's going to pay for it when all of the assets that generate those dollars, cattle, whatever, are destroyed?
Very, very good point. Are there additional questions or comments from the committee? I'd like to thank you both very, very much.
Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Not only for your testimony, but for bringing this very important bill forward.
Thank you.
With that, I'd like to call forward, please, Alexis Ingram. Seeing no one, I'd like to call then Heath Curtis, Jenny Dressler, and Greg Miller.
Great.
Good morning to each of you.
Chair Witt, members of the committee, my name is Heath Curtis. I'm with the Oregon Forest Industries Council. And I think actually that the prior panel did a really good job of talking about this bill. I took the liberty last night to put together a couple pictures to maybe put a face for you on what large wildfire looks like. It's a pretty shocking, I think. And when everybody goes home at the end of the day after putting a fire out, the landowner is left with what you're about to see. So I thought I'd provide a couple examples, one that's already been talked about. The first is the Douglas Complex. This was a 2013 fire ignited in July 26, resulted in over 48,000 acres burned in southwest Oregon. I don't have statistics on everybody because presently we don't do the kind of reports that we're talking about here, but I do have one of our members, and this is just one landowner within that large fire of 48,000 acres, lost 11,000 acres. For that one landowner, the reforestation costs alone exceed $5 million. And in the state of Oregon, by law, if you attempt to salvage any of your land, you have to actually replant those costs and reforest it. That's a good thing, but that's a big cost for that landowner. Furthermore, the net present value of that owner's lost revenue was in excess of $6 million. Thought I'd show you some pictures of what that looks like. Here's a Rabbit Mountain. They had ignited, started up fast. This has been characterized to me as a firestorm, just kind of ripping through dry forest.
And Heath, just to kind of orient some of us, what would be a community that might be in some relative close proximity?
You know, Roseburg is the biggest town that's close there. That's kind of geographically close. But I would say that
we had all that smoke down in Medford. You saw how foggy it was this morning. Mm-hmm. That was good, clear compared to what we had in the middle of the summer and smoke. You couldn't see across the street.
And that that fire blew up quickly, I understand, and there were actually a couple of fires that merged?
Yes, sir. Yeah, you can see those on the prior map. It was why they called that a complex. And to be perfectly honest, there are representatives with the Oregon Department of Forestry here who could speak a lot more knowledgeably than me about the specifics on this fire. I just wanted to show you, these were sent to me. I'm the guy who works in Salem. For anybody who has been close to wildfire, you know, though, that it's a relatively humbling experience. There's nothing gentle or subtle about it. Can be quite terrifying. Here's an aerial picture taken from a helicopter post-fire. You can see where the fire has in some places burned some of the trees and other places stripped them off entirely. Here's a picture of what's left. And again, I have had tours of this to speak to the wildlife concerns. When you walk through that at the end, the interesting thing about it is being in a rural area where it's perfectly quiet, right? There's no birds, there's no anything. It's just quiet and still. That's not good. The Berry Point fire was discussed earlier. This is another one from 2012. 93,000 acres burned, and as they mentioned, a single landowner lost 24,000 acres. The reforestation costs on that effort are also in excess of $5 million, and the lost revenue to that landowner in terms of net present value are in the tens of millions of dollars. Pictures from Berry Point that coming towards you is pretty exciting. And again, this is what you're left with. And I just wanted to remind folks that, you know, a lot of the conversation around fire in Salem necessarily revolves around how do you fund putting fires out, right? And that in itself can be an expensive endeavor, but it's worth reminding ourselves, and bills like this are the perfect opportunity, and I'd commend the author and you, Chair Witt, for hearing it, to look at, you know, what the actual costs on the ground are. If you're the forester who planted this stand, when all of the fire engines go home and the helicopters are gone, you're the one walking out through the middle of this going, man, what do I do now? That's real money, and I think it's characterizing those costs and the shape of this bill are really important. So OFIC strongly supports the bill and would commend it to your approval.
Heath, thank you so much.
Mm-hmm. Chair, members of the committee, my name is Jenny Dressler, and I represent Oregon Farm Bureau. Thank you for the opportunity to testify today on this legislation. Oregon Farm Bureau supports House Bill 2501, which allows for a general accounting of damage to private property following a catastrophic wildfire. The Berry Point fire illustrated that Oregon Department of Forestry's and the U.S. Forest Service have different management policies and values that impact decisions on how to fight fires. Oregon Department of Forestry is responsible for the protection of state and private lands from fire, while U.S. Forest Service is responsible for fire on national forests. Following the Berry Point fire, landowners and ranchers felt that their knowledge of land, fuels, wildland access, and improvements, including fences and cattle safety, was underutilized, and that concerns for their property were not heard by the federal government. They also struggled to get an accurate accounting of the cost of catastrophic wildfire to private property, including grazing, fences, and cattle lost. This legislation goes a long way to address those concerns and bridge the information gap between stakeholders and the state and federal agencies. House Bill 2501 would provide a valuable comparison between wildfire suppression and resource costs. Currently, the Department of Forestry collects data on the cost of wildfire suppression, but not on the value of those private resources that are lost.
Our natural resources in Oregon provide a public and community value, and this legislation will give the legislature and the public an opportunity to be aware of what that loss actually is. We believe, Oregon Farm Bureau believes that this is a good concept that will help inform conversations about managing Oregon's landscape to more effectively prevent catastrophic wildfires in the future. Thank you.
Thank you very much. And Jenny, I want to thank you and your organization for your very broad support of the natural resources in this state. Thank you.
Good morning, Chair Witt, members of the committee, Greg Miller, Weyerhaeuser Company. This is more of a me too and we support in the interest of time testimony, but really do appreciate the concept being brought forward. Any information that we can gather efficiently, cost effectively, with the good work of the Department of Forestry, I think will be helpful for Oregonians to understand what the resource loss is. And just to put it in context, you know, our goal is to keep fires small. And we have been blessed and fortunate that we haven't had any large fires like Roseburg Forest Products over the past few years, because I think we work in a coordinated and complete fashion with the state in terms of keeping those fires small. And, you know, of our 1.3 million acres that we have in the state, we look at this risk as every day during the fire season. And so I think this this kind of information about resource loss would be valuable to Oregonians. Thank you.
Thank you very, very much. Committee members, questions or comments for this panel? Yes, Representative McKeon.
Chair Witt, I will keep this very brief. I think I've referenced this in meetings during the last session. This is an incredibly important issue, and on a personal note, I was driving from our cabin at Agnes up over the hill into the Coquille watershed the day the Biscuit Fire blew up, and I stopped up at the top of the hill to let my dogs out, looked around, and I could see this cloud starting to form, and when I got back to Coos Bay 90 miles away, I could still see that cloud forming, and my parents were basically confined inside the cabin all summer long because the smoke was so dense in the Rogue Valley that they really didn't spend any time outside at all. They were elderly and had some health issues that compromised them, and were on an alert all summer and on an evacuation notice, and could actually see the fire from our place. So I've hiked through that area all of my life and have gone back and watched what's happened. As it hasn't been, there were some issues around how it was managed after the fire occurred and what could be dealt with and what could not. So that's a whole other topic of conversation. But I just wanted to weigh in and say that these are really incredibly important issues, and the cost to the state and the cost to the federal government fighting them is astronomical, and we have to do a better job in providing the resources that you all need to contain these in a way that's in the best interest of Oregonians. It's a devastating, devastating issue that we're dealing with, and it has to rise to a level of great importance. So I thank the Witsits for bringing this, and thank you for being here to weigh in. Very important.
Representative Esquivel.
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. The Biscuit Fire, I'm glad that you mentioned that. The Biscuit Fire was a very large fire. You're right. The Biscuit Fire is a perfect example of what not to do. And if you look in to see, we did very little salvaging, which in turn causes a carbon footprint 10 times greater than the fire itself. And the fire was exacerbated by poor management. The whole thing was just a fiasco as far as I'm concerned. So I would encourage everyone to look into what happened on the Biscuit Fire.
Thank you very, very much. Greg.
Thank you, Chair Witt and members of the committee. I appreciate you bringing your personal experience to the record. I think that's really important. And to Representative McLean's point about health, I think one of your colleagues a couple of years ago, Representative Gene Wisnett, brought forward a bill about how to report on the health effects. Particularly what catalyzed that conversation was the Pole Creek Fire just out of Sisters. And there's nothing more dramatic than driving through Sisters and during quilt season, mind you, but with traffic jams. But during that time, People were literally off the streets, and smoke was inside the stores.
Oh, yeah.
And the art galleries like and folks were just fire. Literally yeah. shut down. Now, I witnessed that fire on top of South Sisters, and that's not a personal brag there, but it was dramatic to see the effect and where the smoke was going. And I don't think there's anybody in Oregon that hasn't lived in Oregon that hasn't experienced some way, somehow, personal first-hand knowledge of or an experience with forest fires. Yeah.
Heath, in one of your first slides showed a kind of the whole complex there, or a big snapshot of it, and exceedingly steep terrain. And I have to believe that there are rivers in the bottom of those canyons. So far this month, we've almost set records for rainfall in February in our state, we're not even halfway through the month. Can you tell us what happens to that fire site, where all that ash ends up after we have major rainfall, that sort of thing, and what problems that creates?
Chair Witt, I probably can't any better than you. It's relatively intuitive, but it ends up in the creek. But what I would say is that in stark contrast to timber harvest in Oregon, where we're able to put buffers between our operations and the streams where fish are, fires don't observe buffers. They break all the rules, and they burn immediately to the stream side. They strip off all the vegetation, and that provides a pretty direct and immediate pathway for delivery of sediment.
And I suspect that after we've burned up the whole hillside and there's nothing left but ash, the ash is in the creek, we have a hillside that's susceptible to erosion and a whole lot of other things. I don't imagine all the ash that ends up in the rivers and creeks in the bottom in any way helps spawning beds too much, or it's probably a good habitat for endangered species. We got to find a better way. I mean, we've just got to find a better way. And certainly appreciate your testimony in favor of this bill. Vice Chair Krieger?
Oregon spent, between the federal and state, I think $7 billion on the Columbia River tributaries and stream restoration, $2.5 billion or so on the coast, not counting private investment of timber companies to enhance water quality and spawning habitat. And some of these catastrophic fires completely destroy all that investment and the resource and the tour that we made in Eastern Oregon. I can't even remember what fire it was, but the silt and ash was over a foot deep across the entire bottom of the stream, and water's running over the top of it. Well, you know what that's going to do for the next, I don't know, we don't even know how long. That stream is basically going to be sterile.
Mm-hmm. Well, with that, committee members, any further questions or comments? Panel members, thank you very, very much. Appreciate your appearance today. Is there anyone else from the public that would like to testify on House Bill? Oh, I see a couple.
I got to stretch a second.
I do, too. I
got a kink and a wrinkle here.
I hear some creaking over there from Krieger.
Lots of it.
The Krieger creak.
That was me creaking.
Welcome, gentlemen. Glad that our hearing sparked some further interest. Good morning.
Thank you, Chair Witt. Committee, for the record, Bill Clothing, Carpenters and Joiners Council. Chair, committee, I've fought this issue for over 30 years. And right now, we're further behind than what we was 30 years ago. I heard the word environmentalist. Everybody in the state is an environmentalist. Everybody in this room is an environmentalist. What has destroyed this country, especially Oregon, the Northwest, is the radical groups, in-state, out-of-state. And to compound the problem is the reception they get from our federal district courts. 75% of these appeals are won by these radical groups. And what that does, you can see what it does. You can see what it did for Oregon. And I'll stay here today. One day, we spend more money decommissioning roads in our forests. I hate to see that. That might be the very road a fire truck can get down. A 10-man crew can get down. We're going to see the Elliott burn again. We're going to see Bull Run burn. There's nothing to stop it. And when you confront these radical environmentalists, I said radical, their reaction is, oh, well, that's nature. Thank you.
Thank you for those sobering comments, Bill.
Chair Witt and committee members, I'm Jim Welsh with Oregon Cattlemen Association. We just want to thank Representative Whitsitt and Senator Whitsitt for bringing this legislation forward and for you hearing it and for your consideration. We've had some really good testimony today, so I'm not going to repeat that, but we the cattlemen have experienced in the last several years very devastating fires on a lot of rangeland, but remember cattlemen also in the 9 million acres that they take to raise the beef that we so enjoy on our plates in the evening. You know, there's a lot of timber in that area too, and we've enjoyed working with the department in trying to develop fire protection districts, and we've been very successful in this state in doing that. But you've heard that, you know, fire sees no boundaries, and the devastation to our wildlife, private land, public land is incredible here in this state, and we're hoping that we can get more information out about this certainly to the population areas in the state, and I think this hearing is a way to do a lot of that. I know it's incumbent on us to do our share of that too, but thank you again today for having this hearing.
Thank you very much. Anything for this panel, committee members? Yes, Representative Whitsitt.
I'd just like to thank everybody who testified in support of this and the committee members for allowing this to be heard, and Chair Witt. It's really important, and I think everybody in this room understands that.
Yes,
thank you. They do,
and Representative, thank you very much for bringing a very important bill forward. Gentlemen, as always, thank you. Is there anyone else from the public who would like to testify on House Bill 2501? Seeing and hearing from no one, I'm going to close the public hearing on House Bill 2501. Chuck, can you tell us what we have coming up next week?
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, next week, Tuesday, our 8 o'clock session, we'll be looking at two bills, House Bill 2050 and House Bill 2181, both similar bills, and they would provide that a county would be exempt from the applicability of statutes banning the use of dogs to hunt or pursue cougars if approved by county voters.
Thank you very much. Committee members, in the past, there have these hearings on this topic, at least, have attracted a number of people. And depending on the size of the crowd that shows up, we may have to limit testimony. A heads up to each of you. And I may need your help next week if it is a large crowd. In getting through a lot of people in a relatively a quick fashion. And I've asked Mr. Gallagher if he would find an egg timer so that we can set that right up here. And if we do have a lot of people and it's necessary to limit testimony, they can gauge as the sands pour through the whatever that is anyway.
Sands
so.
Of time. Sands through the
sands
hourglass.
Of time. There we
there go.
Thank you.
The days of our.
There you go.
So we're going to go there.
It's got to be the days of our legislature, Sal.
Anything else for the good of the order, committee members?
I would like to say one thing.
Yes, please, yeah. Representative Esquivel.
I want to commend this committee because we have urban. We have rural, we have Republican, we have Democrat, but we park those differences at the door when we walk into this committee, and it's a very special committee, and I think that it's because we have a very good chair.
Well, thank you, Representative. I appreciate that. I am equally impressed by each of you. I am the luckiest chair in this building to have the eight of you. With that, we stand adjourned. Thank you all very, very much. Yeah. We stand adjourned. Thank you all very, very much. Yeah.